Welcome to the Seattle Public Library's podcasts of author readings and library events, a series of readings, performances, lectures, and discussions. Library podcasts are brought to you by the Seattle Public Library and Foundation. To learn more about our programs and podcasts, visit our website at www.spl.org. To learn how you can help the Library Foundation support the Seattle Public Library, go to foundation.spl.org.
Good evening. I'm Chris Higashi, Program Manager of the Washington Center for the Book at the Seattle Public Library. Welcome to tonight's event with Dinao Mengistu, one of my favorite writers. Dinao was here for Seattle Reads, we think it was 2009. First, we thank Elliott Bay Book Company for co-presenting this evening, the Seattle Times for generous promotional support for library programs, our author series sponsor, Gary Kunis, and finally, this event is supported by the Seattle Public Library Foundation. Your private gifts to the foundation make possible hundreds and hundreds of free library programs every year. So to foundation donors here with us tonight, we say thank you very much for your support. Okay, Rick Simonson, Elliott Bay, to introduce the rest of the evening. Thank you.
Thank you, Chris, and good evening and welcome. Tonight, he's here, we've been sort of waiting for this next book, for an extraordinary novel that's just been published here in the U.S. Called All Our Names. A book that does many different things, although it connects a certain East African country with certain places in this country, but does so very powerfully and subtly and movingly, primarily in the form of two narrators whose narratives go back and forth in the book, one of whom is set more in the East African country, the other primarily in the Midwest here, and various stories unfold, and even though there are some common characters in parts of the narratives that you as a reader put together, there's also these other elements going on. Those include the life of a woman in this town who lives with her mother and does social work and doesn't have a certain things seemingly going on in her life, and then meets this man who is from another part of the world and of which there is little known by her or others in that town, but certain things come out as her narrative unfolds. And then the other narrative, set primarily in the African country, has a man mostly talking about another fellow and the things they go through at a time of change and turbulent political and upheaval in that country. And it's a book that, without being too specific about where all it is at different times, is symbolic of what's going on in many countries where people have to leave for various reasons and find their way over here and find life here a certain way. So this book does that with a lot of power, a lot of subtlety, and the kind of ambivalence that actually really is kind of bravely done, because sometimes we want these nice, tidy endings and wrapped up emotional things. But this one does some other things without giving it all away, as you'll hear some of that tonight. But it's definitely a book that, as you read, certain things unfold and in the best way you as a reader get to put them together. So Dina will read and talk and answer questions when that part ends. But we're glad he's here tonight, and we're glad you're here tonight, and now ask you to please join in giving a warm welcome back to a remarkable writer, Dinao Mengistu.
Well, thank you very much to Rick and to Chris for bringing me back here and for all of you for coming here. Writing is a pretty solitary act, but you managed to accumulate a lot of debt by sitting by yourself in your room for long stretches of time. And one of the places that I've accumulated a lot of debt to is to this particular institution here, and to Rick and to Elliott Bay and to Chris and to all the wonderful people who have supported me in this city. So I always feel quite welcome when I come back here, and that it's a good reason to write books, just to be able to be like, I have to go back to Seattle and do a reading, regardless of how weird of a trip they make me take to get here. It's always worth it. As Rick did a wonderful job of sort of outlining the structure of this novel, so I won't go into too much detail about it, but he did say something interesting that I really like, which is that there's a lot left for the reader to pull things together. And I was joking the other day that, you know, there's the sort of classic Chinua Achebe novel, Things Fall Apart. And when writing this novel, or after finishing it, writing this novel, I began to think of it as a way of, as almost the inverse of Things Come Together, that this was a way for me to sort of bring together different stories that have oftentimes been considered to be very divergent or very sort of separated. And my other novels, I think, tended to begin with a sense of rupture, that the stories began with men who had left their homes and were forced to recreate themselves in a new country, or were born in the United States and were still forced to recreate themselves because they felt alienated from it. This novel started off on a much more kind of optimistic note. I began this story by thinking about this particular moment in post-colonial African history where there's a lot of optimism and potential. And I began to think, well, there's also a similar moment that exact same time as we had that same optimism here in the U.S. In the civil rights era. So 1962, you have the independence of Uganda, in 1963, the independence of Kenya, and you also have the March on Washington with Dr. Martin Luther King. And by 1968, you have the assassination of Martin Luther King, and by 1969, you have the rise of strong autocratic regimes across the continent. So rather than thinking of these stories as being somehow radically different or not even thinking of them as being remarkably intertwined, I thought they are actually really, really similar. They carry a lot of weight when you bring it down to the level of an individual and the level of a person rather than the level of a nation or a state. So this story takes place between two different narrators. There's Isaac telling the story of his friendship in Kampala in the early 1970s, and there's Helen, who's telling about her relationship with a man named Isaac in the early 1970s in the Midwest. And the passage that I'm going to... There's... It's like you suddenly gain more power by doing... There's Helen's story, which I'll read from here. She's a social worker in the Midwest, and part of her voice came from the idea that we oftentimes are growing increasingly familiar with the narrative of what happens when somebody comes to this country. And I wanted to write from the opposite point of view of what is it like to be the person who has to welcome the newcomer into your house, since that's the other part of the conversation, right? It is a conversation very much. So this is Helen's part of the story. And Isaac has come to town, and they've begun to fall in love. And their relationship is about to undergo a series of difficulties. I knew my time with Isaac was temporary. His visa granted him 1 year, and we never discussed the possibility of extending it. I did, despite my best efforts to stay grounded, sometimes imagine that one day we'd drive together to City Hall, nicely dressed, carrying simple silver bands picked up from the town's largest general store in our pockets, so that we could declare our marriage in front of a judge, in the hope that by doing so, we would be able to make something permanent, a shared life, which, as the saying goes, no man or woman could tear us under. I imagined us living on a large farm far away from any town and family, with only chickens and acres of corn for company. How would you feel about living on a farm? I asked Isaac. That depends, he said. Are you there with me? Maybe if you were good, I'd come visit you on the weekends, I said. When it came to more domestic fantasies, however, we fell apart. The distance between what we had and what we wanted was too obvious if we dreamed close to home. I remember taking him to the post office once so he could mail a letter to his mother. While we stood in line to buy stamps, I asked him what her name was. He looked up as if he no longer knew the answer to that question or had lost the right to answer it. Her name doesn't matter, he said. Everyone only calls her Imaye. When we reached the teller, Isaac handed me the envelope. He was shy speaking in front of strangers, so I was the one who asked how many stamps were needed to mail the letter. While we waited, I tried to pronounce her name the same way he had. I said out loud, Imaya, Imayu. Not even close, he said. He pronounced it once more so I could hear how far off I was, and finally, after failing two more times, I laughed and said, forget it. When we meet, I'll just call her mother. He became silent. What I had said bothered him. I didn't know him well enough to understand why, but I felt the distance expanding between us. We paid for the stamps and left the post office, and it wasn't until we were alone in the car that he told me what he was thinking. It doesn't do us any good to talk about things that will never happen, he said. I promised myself I would never ask him about his family again, And by and large, I stayed true to that. I thought as well, however, that if we couldn't have a future, I could at least try and make the most of our present. We were running out of errands and chores to complete, and it was time I told him we moved on to something else. We're going to have to find other things to do, I said, except go to the grocery store. What would you like? I thought of all the possible options open to us. I thought of what normal couples did. They went to the movies, dinner. They invited friends over on the weekends. They had beach vacations. I knew we couldn't get away with any of that, so I told Isaac, I don't know, but I'll come up with something. I decided over breakfast with my mother that certain risks had to be taken if Isaac and I were going to have any sort of life together. I didn't make this decision lightly. She asked me that morning while setting the table, do you have a new friend, Helen? She was dependent on gentle phrasing. That was the register we carried all our conversations in. Would you like to help me with the shopping this weekend, Helen? Do you think it's time we change the curtains in the living room, Helen? I always responded in kind. No one that I know of, I said, but I promise to keep looking. The last time she had asked that question was shortly after I began working with David. I spoke of him often around the house, and if there's anyone I spent the weekends and evenings with, it was him. She asked me repeatedly if David was a special friend, a hope abruptly relinquished once she met him. Telling her about Isaac wouldn't have brought her any comfort. David was the only one who had suspected, and even he was quietly alarmed by the suggestion. When we were alone in his office, he had said, I hope you know what you're doing with your Dickens. There wasn't a reproach. I had the feeling he found saying those words embarrassing. I nodded and tried to make it all seem lighthearted. Of course I know, I said. I'm a professional at this. We weren't divided like the South, and we had nothing to do with any of the large cities in the North. We were exactly what geography had made us. Middle of the road. Never bitterly segregated, but with lines dividing black from white all over town. Whether in neighborhoods, churches, schools, or parks. We lived semi-peacefully apart, like a married couple in separate wings of a large house. That was the image I had in mind during breakfast when I decided something different had to be done. Change. It seemed to be everywhere except Laurel. I set my sights low. Incremental progress was my philosophy. We didn't have to be heroes. There had been enough of those already. And in many ways, I reasoned, Isaac and I had already picked up the fight. We just hadn't known that's what we were doing. I made a list of all the places we had gone to in the 3 months since we'd met. The grocery store, the mall, post office, bank, Goodwill. I thought of them while sitting at my desk and tried to remember if any obvious signs of affection had passed between us. I came up with a crude value system to measure each trip by. 1. Shopping for food. After sex and children, what could be more intimate in America than choosing what kind of meat to cook? The grocery store was the first place in our town that I knew for certain we had conquered. We went once, sometimes twice a week. We laughed in the aisles. We took turns pushing the cart. I gave Isaac cooking lessons at the meat counter. Those were all important victories. 2. The post office. I had to admit that it had been a terrible loss. And because it was a government office, I felt I had to weigh the defeat a bit more. One post office defeat was the equivalent of 2 grocery store victories. Mail was dangerous. Personal letters especially. They pointed to great distances and old, mysterious lives I knew nothing about. There were tellers instead of clerks, forms that had to be filled. It would be difficult, if not impossible, to win in a place like that. 3. Anything else that was related to shopping. Furniture, plates, cutlery. We had chosen all that together right under the skeptical eye of the clerks. Had Isaac and I touched each other once, I would have said we dealt an important blow against segregation. But I had to be honest. I knew we never touched except by accident, so I had to temper the victory with the knowledge that we could have done better. What I needed next were new targets. The first one that came to mind was the most obvious, and I couldn't believe I hadn't thought of it before. A week after our defeat at the post office, I called Isaac from my office and said I wanted to take him out to lunch. To lunch? Yes, I said, for lunch. I'm tired of eating at my desk alone. I chose the same diner my father had gone to every morning, and where as a child I joined him on Saturday afternoons. It was the only place in Laurel that I associated exclusively with my father. I'd been going there for years on my own and with friends and coworkers, but those other occasions were mere intrusions on the central event. A semi-regular father-daughter lunch that had lasted for 2 years and that had ended in one of those booths with my father promising to visit every week once he moved out. A month went by before I saw him again. I stopped worrying and then with more time caring if he returned. Gradually, my memories of him were distilled into a single fluid image of a man confined to a booth or counter with thick sideburns and occasionally a soft mustache that moved when he spoke, which wasn't often. The diner was never officially segregated, but I couldn't remember anyone who wasn't white eating there either. In this case, it was etiquette and not a sign that served as a cover for our division. Before I left to pick up Isaac, I wrote down on a piece of paper in case I forgot it later. We have every right to be here. We arrived shortly after noon, when I knew the restaurant would be crowded. Isaac said he can meet me there, but I insisted on picking him up so everyone could see us walk in together. The lunch counter was already full. Of the half dozen men sitting there, I knew three by name and the others were familiar. Bill, whose chest and forearms were known throughout Laurel for the strong, black hair that sprouted from them, was leaning over the counter, smiling half-heartedly at everyone who came and left. My father used to tell me to be careful with my food when Bill stood over us. He sheds, he told me, like a dog. In the scripted version that had played in my head during the five-minute drive from Isaac's apartment to the restaurant, the entire diner fell silent as soon as we entered. All eyes turned toward us, and we ignored them. We didn't hold hands. That would have been too provocative. But we did pause to look at each other with what I thought of as an abundance of affection. In the version we lived, no one stopped talking. Bill saw me as soon as I walked in and pointed to a table in the middle of the diner. Isaac followed me, but I was so focused on making it to the table that I never stopped to notice if anyone was staring at him. We took our seats. When I picked up my menu as a cover so I could look around the room, I realized no one had noticed yet how remarkable we were. Isaac saw my gaze wandering. "Why are we here?" he asked me. I looked around the room again. I thought I saw Bill and two of the men at the counter staring in our general direction. No particular reason, I told him, I just wanted to get out. I asked Isaac what he had done all day. "I was at the library," he said. He described the book on contemporary American architecture he had been reading. I told him twice that it sounded very interesting. "Fascinating," I said, "what they can build these days. Chit-chat. Simple conversation." When Isaac put his hand on the table, I took his pinky and index finger in mine. I held them for 2, maybe 3 seconds while looking at the menu. I used a strand of loose hair as an excuse to let go. Our waitress came and took our order. I ordered the fried chicken. Isaac pointed to the Denver omelet and let me order for him. After our waitress left, I turned my attention back to the counter. I wanted to tell Isaac what my father had said about Bill, but he was no longer there. And with him gone, the men at the counter stopped pretending they weren't staring at us. I tried to ignore them. But then our waitress came back empty-handed, and I felt certain that if I looked over again at them, I'd see them smiling. She was young, fresh out of high school. Had I been younger, I would have known who she was. She had a kind, round face and wore her dark brown hair in a bun. She leaned over and whispered to us, "Bill wants to know if you would like to take your food with you." She was doing her best to be kind. Isaac understood immediately what was happening, and in the same breath knew how to respond. Before I could answer, he told her, "No, we would rather eat here." Polite yet determined, she nodded her head. She had no idea what else she could do. Isaac pursed his lips and waited until she had returned to the kitchen before turning his attention to me. "Do you come here frequently?" he asked. I nodded yes, then changed my mind and said, "No, not really." "Which one is it?" "I used to come here when I was younger," I said, "but I don't that often anymore." It was true. The diner was a few blocks away from my office, but I went there once a month at most. "We should go," I said. Isaac hadn't stopped staring at me since the waitress left. I was tempted to confess my reasons for bringing him, but I realized I didn't have to. The best intentions didn't change what was obvious. I should have known better. I'm not going to run, he said. I'm going to eat my lunch. And briefly, I felt bold again. I saw myself adding this lunch to my column of victories once I returned to my office. If we made it through this, then perhaps there is nothing in the world that we couldn't conquer. From post offices to movie theaters and the all-too-perilous family dinner at home. I was imagining what my mother would say if Isaac were to show up on one Sunday evening when his lunch arrived. The same waitress brought it, although this time she didn't look at either of us. Her embarrassment was evident. Isaac's omelet was on a stack of thin paper plates, barely large enough to hold the food. A plastic knife and fork had been wrapped in a napkin and placed on top, a strangely delicate touch that she must have been responsible for. He unwrapped the knife and fork and placed the palm-sized napkin on his lap. "Do you mind if I start? I hate my eggs when they're cold," he said. He spoke so calmly, I assumed he was joking, and I suppose to some degree he was. I tried to laugh. "Ha ha." But then he cut his omelet into 7 even pieces before taking the first bite. He chewed slowly. With every bite, I was reminded that we were no longer, if ever, on the same side. He had finished his omelet by the time my order arrived on the standard cream-colored plates used for everyone other than Isaac. The waitress tried to walk away quickly, but I grabbed her wrist and I told her I wanted to cancel my order. "Tell Bill that I don't want to eat here," I said. The poor child. She was struggling not to cry. We didn't make it any easy on her. "Leave the plate," Isaac said. "We're going to stay and eat it." She hurried back to the kitchen. I stared at the plate of chicken and mashed potatoes and blinked twice, childishly hoping I could make it vanish. "Please," I said to him, "let's leave now." He shook his head no. "Not until we both finish our lunch," he said. "That's what you wanted, isn't it?" If that was his way of settling the score, then I thought I could play along just as well. For the next 10 minutes, I slowly took my food apart. With my first half-hearted stab into the chicken, all the momentum was gone. There was nothing we could change. I felt a regression back to my mother's kitchen table, where I'd spent many nights and afternoons laboring to finish a meal that my father had never shown up for and that my mother had refused. I had always known that there was something cruel in her insistence that I eat every bite on my plate while my father's food grew cold next to me. She needed a victim besides herself. And when I finally looked up at Isaac after a few minutes and saw him smiling at me, I knew there was something cruel lurking in his gaze. I was too busy creating, though, a new story to linger on that thought. In this story, Isaac and I were still heroes. And the fact that we chose to sit there and linger when every part of me wanted to run was proof of the sacrifices we were willing to make. When we left the restaurant and were back in the car, he said to me, "Now you know, this is how they break you, slowly, in pieces." And I'll stop there. But if anybody has any questions, it's always nice to read, but it's always nicer to have a conversation. So if you have any comments, skeptical ideas, probing questions. Oh, the question was my own the question of language, which is always the question in many ways, and whether or not I grew up familiar, whether or not I grew up with English as my first language. You know, I was born in Ethiopia. I didn't really speak English probably until I was about 4, maybe 3, but afterwards it became my first language. And I can understand Amharanya, but I can't really speak it. So I do really work and think and write in English completely. It is very much my, obviously, I think I don't, it's should be, you know, like I'm an English major. I went to graduate school in English. So it is very much my natural tongue. I don't know if this matters for the book, but I wrote this book actually while living in France. And I lived there for 5 years, and I didn't speak a word of French when I got there. And I'm pretty fluent now, but I didn't know any of it when I was there. And part of the great joy of that was actually being able to be isolated inside of a language. So you walk around the streets and you have no idea what anybody says to you. And that's a really, it's great. You can be public, you can be out all the time, but yet you're incredibly private at the same way. And because I'm quite shy, I had a great fear of saying anything, even as I began to grow more familiar with this other language. So to some degree, the book benefited, I think, from a certain linguistic isolation. I got to spend a lot of time deeply immersed in my head and in my thoughts without having to worry about anybody else's words sort of infecting my own language. And I think I probably got a closer sense of why it's so hard to speak in another language when you're not familiar with it, even if you know it. So this character, Isaac, does know English. I mean, he grows up learning English by reading Victorian literature, so he is quite comfortable with it. But that's a very different state of mind than being able to actually publicly perform it. And I'm really curious about that distinction, right? The way we live our lives in private versus the spaces that we're allowed to occupy when we step beyond the walls of our front door. And that's true both for him as a person and also really for their relationship. I'm just taking your question and drawing it out really far now. But that is sort of what happens with their relationship as well. You know, they have this interracial relationship that cannot exist beyond the borders of their house. And so what happens in that scene right there is they're moving beyond a certain comfort zone. They're moving it out into a public sphere. And that question of Isaac's ability to perform language publicly, right, like when he's at the post office, that's a big thing for him, that he could say how many stamps are needed for this letter. He knows those words, but he can't say them. He's uncomfortable. He's uncertain about who he is in that public space. And yet, of course, when he's with Helen, he can communicate. He can say who he is in many other ways. So they all kind of closely intertwine, I think.
Yes.
Yeah, I think that's true. The gentleman up here made a comment that the denial of immigration is partly a result of being afraid to look at your own experience, and I do think that's sort of true. We are all sort of, without making it seem too sort of hokey and sentimental, let's say that we're all migrants in some ways. But the idea of what an immigrant is very much a construct, right? So we use that term, when we use it publicly, when we use it in political terms, it's very much an arbitrary construct. There's a British writer who I was with at an event, and he said the great thing about being from the West is that wherever we go, we're never immigrants. We're always expats. I lived in France for 5 years. No one ever said I was an immigrant. No one ever looked at me like an immigrant. I was always an American first and foremost because of my passport and because of the privileges that are accorded to it. You stop being an immigrant not because of you've left home, but because of a certain political economic decision that has decided to cast you and brand you as being that. And there's a very, I think we sort of have to examine the language that we use when we use those terms and the way that we use that as a way of why I really don't like the category of immigrant literature, especially when we think about it in the context of America, because one, this is a country where basically no one has the right to say that. I mean, like, I'll give like Louise Erdrich and Sherman Alexie, basically the only people who could say they're writing American literature. All of us are writing immigrant literature since then. Or Philip Roth in an interview said, I don't write Jewish fiction. I don't write Jewish literature. I'm not writing in Hebrew. I'm not writing in Yiddish. I'm writing in English in America. My characters may happen to be Jewish, but that is part of what this country is. And that couldn't be any more true for immigrants than anything else. So the construct of the sort of immigrant narrative as well is to me, seems increasingly we use that term much more now than we did 10 years ago, not because immigrant narratives are new. Like Saul Bellows would have been an immigrant writer. He was born in Canada. No one ever called him that. They did call him a Jewish writer, though, for a very long time until now. Is that what we're really talking about is a way of factioning off our cultural narrative, because that's what it is, right? It's not the narrative of one person. It's the narrative of our entire country into different ethnic factions. So we're going to say now, here's our Chinese-American literature. Here's our Peruvian-American literature. Here's our Russian-American literature. Here's our South American literature. And you think, well, all of these writers, of course, do come from these multiple places, right? I don't deny the multiplicity of that. But what I assert is that America's sort of its greatest gift is its ability to demand multiplicity. Even though other people may try to argue for the singular narrative of what America is, that's always a lie. The only singular narrative that it has is that it's going to change and that other people will come from everywhere and can continually change it as they move with it, too. So I don't like that, yeah. Yeah, you know, definitely I think there's probably no greater way of showing the divisions than trying to force things into the most intimate relationship possible, you know, so part of what that happens in this novel is set in the early 1970s, when to some degree you have places that have convinced themselves that the sort of rules of segregation have passed and have sort of ended, which is only true until you bring people really closely together, and that becomes you begin to see just how deep those fault lines are, and at the same time it's also a way of asserting that those fault lines are fairly shallow, that you know these characters. One of the things that I like about these characters, without giving away too much of the novel, is that they come together not based on any sort of color of their skin, and despite their radically different histories, they come together because they actually share so much more in common than almost anybody else. They're both, Helen may be very Midwestern, very rooted in this place, but she's also sort of lost and is seeking something else. And she also has a very, her opening lines, and maybe this ties into the second half of your question, which is really when I knew Helen was a real character, is she talks about how she would go out into the backyard of her house to scream. And for me, that was one way of trying to assert the strength of her identity and to say that she's also a woman who's choosing not to follow the traditional course and paths that other women would have been suspected to have. You know, she decides not to have a family at a young age like most women would have. She tries to have a career. She is still very close to her mother, but she decides to sort of reject a certain normative category of what a woman should be. And whether I would like to hope that does espouse certain feminist ideals, I hope that's evident in the text, but I'm not the one to decide those things. But yeah, she was very much created out of that desire to have a very strong female character who was willing to kind of try the best that she can to dictate and control her relationships and her lives outside of what people expected them to be. And her and Isaac, what you know they are able to do in the best possible way is find a bit of grace with each other. You know, their relationship, as flawed as it may be and as complicated as it may be, you know, is like a sort of balm for both of them. Somebody else have a question that I missed over here? You have to read the book. Easiest answer. the question was, she has a question about the names. Because there's a lot of play on names. The more I look at the book, the more I realize I really went a bit wild with the names. There's identities that are shifted, but there's really the narrator of the novel talks at the very beginning about how when he comes to Kampala, he sheds all the names that his family had given him. So you inherit names from generation after generation in Ethiopia. So your father's last name becomes your first name, and you would know your grandfather's name. So he has this long list of names behind him, and he decides to shed those names in order to come up with something new, which is a very... it's a very traditional sort of narrative when we talk about sort of migrants in general. Like people, especially coming to this country, they lose their names in order to, either because they have no choice or because they want to reinvent themselves, right? So Bob Dylan was not born Bob Dylan. And I always liked that idea. I like the capacity for self-identification and for freedom that comes with that. I also think that there's a great loss that comes with that, that you give up something incredibly vital in order to have that possibility. So the characters are renaming themselves throughout the course of the novel. There's also a way in which to name something is to have a lot of power. You know, like one of the first things that happens in the Bible is you go around naming things, and that defines what they are. And so the characters are, to some degree, reacting against that, and at the same time embracing it. So it's a way of answering your question in the most vague possible terms. I think this woman here. It is. I mean, it's in all of my books. Oh, the question, I'm sorry, Chris. The question was, how do I stay in touch with, since I left Ethiopia at a young age, how do I stay in touch with that part of my identity and whether or not I'm in touch with any of the writers? I'd say it's in every one of my books. Even if I never spoke to another Ethiopian, even if I lived in a cave in Antarctica, you can't deny the fact that culture has in my work. It's inside of every page. And so I tend to reject the idea that somehow I have to, I mean, I go back to Ethiopia regularly. I go back to Africa almost every year. I work as a journalist. I specifically cover conflicts and violence in Africa out of a very deliberate sense that these are stories that aren't properly discussed. And at the same time, I do believe that, you know, I want to make sure that it doesn't seem like I feel like I have to perform my Ethiopian-ness or my identity for others. You know, then I always find that a little bit frustrating when people ask me if I'm engaged, where I know I'm engaged, and the fact that I write about it should be is my proof of that. I think everyone heard those questions. For the record, what steered me towards literature, and whether or not I think there's a commonality, perhaps, between all immigrant narratives? I came to literature because it kind of saved me. You know, I went to a private high school where there were very few people of color, and no Ethiopians, obviously. So I grew up very much buffeted by a sense of confused and troubled racial identities and the sort of segregation and racism that comes with that. And I found a lot of solitude and peace and comfort in literature. So books became the place that I was the most comfortable at. So I became really I became really comfortable being alone as a result of books, and then gradually realized that's one of the things that I wanted to do maybe more than anything, was that I loved language and that I loved the capacity that language offers you when you sit and lose yourself in a story. There's some great space and freedom that exists there that I can't find anywhere else, which has always been true. And whether I think all immigrant narratives, no, I don't. That's why I hate the term immigrant narrative, because what are we talking about when we say that, right? So if you come here from, if you migrated here from Ireland in 2010 because of the economic crisis, do you have a similar story to somebody who came here from Yemen? No, you don't. The only thing that we can share sometimes is perhaps a sense of having lost some place, but those things are so personal and so unique and so particular that when we begin to even try to subsume these narratives under one identity, under one brand, under one total category like immigrant narrative, we strip them of their capacity for singularity. We strip them of their capacity to really listen and hear these stories as the stories of X person or Y person. We think of them as, here's the story of someone who left their house and now they're here. And if they come from a sort of poor nation, then they're probably happy to be here. If they come from a wealthy nation, they came here because they had a better job. You know, so we summarize them. So I think as much as possible as a writer, what you try to do is you try to break away from that tendency of summation. You try to break away from the idea of genericizing our stories into one block. You know, like, what's the story of the African-American experience? I have no idea. There is not one story. There's many of them. What's the story of the Irish-American community? There isn't one. If you grew up in the South or if you grew up in New York, you have very different narratives. So we need as many different stories as we can in order to assert that. I should probably back off. It is clearly a part. It's like the first thing that she notices about him, obviously, when he gets off the plane, is that the color of his skin and the fact that he comes from someplace else. I mean, I'm not trying to sort of turn some sort of like rosy shaded eyes where everyone's, but it's there. But yet at the same time, what sustains their relationship has to move beyond that, of course. Like, it doesn't sort of exist there. And within that scene in the novel, you'll notice that part of what he's also doing is he's compelling her to share in this experience. There's a shared cruelty that happens in that moment where he is forcing her to sort of be very uncomfortable, and he's asking her to kind of suffer to some degree, and he's asking her to take on and play a position that she does not want to play. And there's something mean about that, without a doubt, and I wanted that cruelty to be part of his culpability and part of her culpability as well. You know, so they are forced to some degree to meet each other by having that experience together. So if they just walked away, then that experience actually wouldn't have been shared. And that closing line is some way of him saying, now you've seen this, right? Now you know how this feels to some degree, or I'm trying to get you to understand that it's not just enough to walk away and say it's okay. So the question was, how long do I spend with my characters' names? In this case, Helen came really quickly. Helen, I just sort of knew she was Helen. I don't know why. She was there, and she was Helen. Isaac, however, in 2000, when I was still an undergraduate, I began trying to write my first novel, and the characters, there are two main characters in that story, one named Isaac, the other one named Jonas. Jonas was the narrator of my second novel that was published, How to Read the Air. Isaac became the narrator of this story. So to some degree, that first novel was terrible and failed and is sitting like in a basement in Brooklyn somewhere. I have no idea what will ever happen to it. But at least it did give me these characters, or the genesis of these characters to some degree. So Isaac was waiting for like 15 years to come out. Or 12 years at least to come out. So he was very different when he finally did show up in this book, but at least the name had been sort of waiting in the wings for me for a really long time. I'm sorry if I'm missing you up there. Yeah. So the question was whether the character, how I traced the character's journey from Ethiopia to the U.S. And those experiences. And the second part is the sort of exportation of Ethiopian culture, would you say, into an American society, whether or not that's happening. I'd say in this novel, my first novel dealt a lot with that. It dealt a lot with the sort of the process and struggle of trying to find a way and home in America after having been here for 15 years, after having left Ethiopia during the communist revolution. My first narrator, Sefa Stefanos, was very much born out of that story and that experience. And in this story, it's not that. the character leaves Ethiopia, but he leaves Ethiopia, you know, he's not leaving for any political reasons. He's leaving because he wants to become a writer, and he wants to be join this college campus full of students. So he comes to another African country in order to do that. And what marks him the most aren't the experiences of Ethiopia, but really the experience of his friendship on this college campus with another young man, their attempts at joining a revolutionary movement, and how that forces him to come to America. Those were the concerns of this novel, because to some degree this novel is very much in conversation with the other two books. So the other two books traced some of those parts, but on this book I wanted to move to someplace else and to do something different. I'm not sure if you're worried about the sort of idea of Ethiopian American culture and how that's formed. I mean, I think Ethiopians are sort of incredibly vital inside of this culture. I think we're probably more represented in numbers beyond or represented in scale beyond our numbers. There's great Ethiopian chefs, there's great Ethiopian painters, there's other Ethiopian writers. So I think our cultural impact in America is pretty significant already. We haven't really been here for that long, so I'm pretty proud of what we've done, and pretty proud to see what we'll keep doing. I need to ask other people. All three of these books have been part of, I think, of like a long conversation that began with The Beautiful Things That Heaven Bears, and that was one part of the story. And to some degree, this novel should actually, in a chronological way, is actually the precedent—that's not the word. you're getting tired when you make up words that don't exist. Precedes the other two novels, at least chronologically, because it takes place before a lot of the sort of political conflicts that gave rise to the other two narrators. So this novel actually takes place before there was any communist revolution, before there was really a lot of the sort of political violence that came through the late 70s and early 80s. This is actually the first book, but it's the last book in many ways as well. But yet it does continue the sort of idea, this conversation that you, as a writer, you just start having with yourself, with the culture at large, the one around you, not only about, of course, again, not only about the way people leave, but really about what happens when when we all converge. What happens when I show up at your doorstep one day? What happens when an Ethiopian family arrives in Peoria, Illinois, 1980, and they go to an all-white Southern Baptist church, which is what happened to our family? That alters that landscape. It alters the culture, the community. It alters us as well. So you begin to try to figure out, what does that alteration look like? How do those sort of ripples continue across generations and across individuals? I think of the reader specifically in one context, which is that I give the reader a lot of space. I believe, as Rick was saying, I don't tidy up my novels. I don't conclude them. I don't wrap them up. Because I believe that's the space for the reader to do so. I have my very strong ideas of how the stories end, but I want the readers to hopefully have enough room to do so for themselves as well. And other than that, I leave my readers pretty free. I don't have a reader in my mind. I definitely do not write for an audience. If I did, it would be a really big one. I would be like, who really likes to buy books? And what do they want to read? And they would all be set on the Upper West Side of New York and in Seattle. It would not take place in Kampala in 1970, I'll tell you that. that answers your question. I don't want to deny that I do research, but I don't think of it as research because I work as a journalist from time to time. So in between all of my novels, I've gone to report from different places, from different conflict zones. And Uganda was one of those places that I went to. Other than that, I'm imagining this. I was not in Uganda in 1970. I wasn't even born, of course, back then. But in the process of covering those stories, I end up doing a lot of research before I report about any place or about any conflict. I spend months trying to understand those stories as much as I can, trying to understand the histories of those countries. So I did spend a lot of time. But I spent a lot of time reading through Uganda, reading through sort of that post-colonial period in order to understand the conflicts that were happening in 2007, 2008. Not because I thought they would work their way into my fiction, but they do eventually. And so the characters and the landscapes and the settings here, if you were sort of like walking through my brain, which would be very strange place to walk through. You would see that, you know, I'm stealing landscapes from Eastern Congo, from Uganda, from Rwanda, from Sudan. I'm stealing references and episodes of violence from those places that I wrote about, but I didn't write about perhaps as well as I wanted to. I didn't get a chance to write about all of them, or what I did write about wasn't enough. They weren't finished. So they worked their way into my fiction. And then it's with fiction that I can re-inhabit them. But I'm not really concerned about the facts. You know, there's a great Marilyn Robinson quote from Housekeeping where her character says, "Facts tell us nothing. If anything, it's facts that need explaining." And I tend to think that's part of what we do in fiction. We're not trying to, if you want a factual encyclopedic history of what happens in a country, you know, we have Wikipedia, which is its own form of fiction anyway. So I would rather give you my form of fiction. And I'm not trying to tell you what happened on X date, but I want to give you a sense of a moment, of a people, of a person. And hopefully that gives you the explanation that facts can't give. I'd say tomorrow you guys are lucky. If you go to Elliott Bay, you'll see Teju, who's awesome, who's I think a remarkable writer. So Every Day is for the Thief is sitting with me right now. There's a Canadian writer named Joseph Boyden who has a book called The Arenda, which is coming out in April, which is also pretty compelling and interesting to me. I do a lot of rereading, so this novel is a huge debt to a Sudanese writer, Tayeb Salah, a book called The Season of Migration to the North, which is really should be that should be the sort of like post-colonial Bible in some ways. It should be one. It's one such a classic, beautiful novel, and somehow managed to slip under the radars for many, many years. But it's Tayeb Salah, Season of Migration to the North. So sort of an emphatic promoter of that novel. It was published in 1971, too. So yeah, I think we're in a great period for contemporary literature, I think. So thank you all very much for coming.
This podcast was presented by the Seattle Public Library and Foundation and made possible by your contributions to the Seattle Public Library Foundation. Thanks for listening.